Iambic Audiobooks presents Steel Whispers by Hayden Trenholm, Book 2 of the Steel Chronicles, read by Mark F. Smith. Chapter 1. I deal in death every day. That's my job. I've learned not to let it touch me. You can't function as a cop if you do. Even 20 years behind a desk, where you're twice removed from death itself, can't change that. The call came, as these calls always do, at 3 a.m., 3:14 to be exact, Wednesday, March 16, 2044. I answered the phone on the second ring. "Superintendent Steele?" The voice on the other end of the line sounded young. These days they all sounded young. "You got him," I said.
"I hope I didn't wake you," said the cop.
"Nah, I had to get up to answer the phone anyway." An old joke, but it still got a laugh. Truth was, I'd been up for over an hour. I checked the caller ID. "What can I do for you, Constable Phelan?"
"You left orders to be called if we had another Borg murder. Same M.O. as the last four."
"Where are you?" Phelan gave me an address in the industrial southeast. "I'm on my way." Superintendents aren't supposed to get involved in crime scene investigations. We're supposed to sit in our offices and read reports and send younger, brighter minds to do the dirty work. But as other senior officers around the Calgary Police Force will tell you, Frank Steele is a special case. A head case, according to most. I sat back in my chair and drank the last of my hot milk, thankful I'd resisted the call of my old friend, Jack Daniels, from where he rested in the cupboard above the kitchen sink. I'd been rereading Illegal Alien by Robert J. Sawyer, and I slipped a bookmark into place and put it back on the shelf. I don't read a lot of science fiction. Mysteries are more my forte, but this one was a great courtroom drama. Maybe I was hoping his exploration of alien motivations would help me figure out what was happening with the Borg. These days, I needed all the inspiration I could get. I'd asked Phelan to call for a cruiser, and by the time I'd gotten on a tie and a suit jacket and rounded up my badge and gun, they were buzzing for me from downstairs. At this time of night, traffic on the Deerfoot Freeway was almost manageable, and we made it from my northwest apartment to the crime scene in under 20 minutes. I had a pretty good idea of what to expect. The Borg, as they were known in the popular press, had been a growing subculture in most of the Western world for the last 10 years, ever since the cost of mechanical and cybernetic upgrades had fallen from astronomical to merely exorbitant. What they called themselves, I couldn't tell you. You need a high-end vocoder to make the sound. Some of the Borg didn't look much different from regular humans, with all of the modifications and augmentation hidden under their skin. Most liked to flaunt their changes. Artificial eyes and ears, new limbs ending in claws or tentacles or both, metal skullcaps of gleaming chrome. People overestimate the number of Borg, in part because people tend to do that with minorities, but also because Borg culture had spawned a whole crowd of wannabes, kids with non-functional copies of Borg modifications pasted on their skin or fitted over their real arms or legs. But the four dead bodies that had turned up in Calgary dumpsters over the last few weeks had been the real thing, though what they were after all their modifications had been carved out of their flesh was difficult to say. We'd been able to identify three of the victims through DNA records in the National Identity Bank, but the fourth was still listed as a Jane Doe and seemed likely to remain so unless we caught the perps. Based on the microscopic residue found in the wounds, she'd had her face largely rebuilt out of metal and ceramic, and both arms replaced, probably turned into multi-use tools, so what was left after her killers were done was pretty difficult to ID. The dumpster where the fifth victim was housed was under a spotlight, and I had the cruiser pull right up to the scene. The ambulance was waiting to make its delivery to the crime lab, but the body was still in situ. Detective Lily Chin was talking to our new forensics guru, Dr. Vanessa Pham. I walked past them before they noticed me and climbed up on the step stool that had been placed beside the metal bin. This Borg had barely started the modification process, so his body was mostly intact. His right hand had been severed, and the vocoder had been cut out of his throat. An artificial ear had been torn away along with the top of his skull, but the face was intact, staring up at me with wide-open eyes. All expression had leached out in the hours since death, but I had no real problem recognizing him. "I deal in death every day, but it's different when it's your own son." I was still standing there, feeling stupid like I was half asleep, trying to wake up from a bad dream, when Lily Chin came up to me and put her hand on my arm.
"Sorry, Frank. I didn't see you until it was too late. The identification came in after Phelan called you. I would have warned you, but—"
"But my cell was turned off," I said, surprised at how calm my voice was. My cell was sitting on the bedside table, I thought, as if that somehow mattered. As if anything mattered right now other than the fact I was standing in front of a dumpster looking into the face of my dead son and wondering how the hell he could afford modifications and when did he get them anyway. Josh and I had never been close, and the distance between us had grown into a gulf since his mother and I divorced 7 years ago. He'd been 17 then, just starting his fine arts degree at the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology. And now, he was lying in a dumpster like a stranger. I reached out to touch his face.
"Frank,"
Chin's voice came from far away.
"Superintendent Steele!"
The hard edge in her voice brought me back to the here and now.
"Forensics hasn't cleared the scene yet, sir. You can't touch the body."
"It's not a body, it's my goddamn son!" But I jerked my hand back. "I'm sorry, Lily. I'm sorry. Getting old, I guess." I took a couple of steps away from the dumpster and fumbled for a cigarette, forgetting for a moment that I'd quit on the day my divorce from Dorothy, Josh's mother, had become final.
"Maybe you should head home, Frank. I can wrap up here," Chin said, her voice surprisingly gentle.
I didn't think she had that in her, but I guess you never stop learning about people. I looked over at the dumpster. "Yeah, right." "No," I said. "I'll head downtown and get an early start on the day. I should call the victim's mother." It's the first thing they teach you in detective school. Don't let it get personal. Keep your distance from death, or it will swallow you whole. I wondered what chapter of the manual told you how to tell your ex-wife her baby boy was dead. I sat at my desk, staring at the phone, trying to remember the last time I had seen Josh. Was it 2 years ago, or three? I thought of calling Amber, the daughter I'd had during my brief, tumultuous first marriage. But I hadn't seen her since her mother's funeral 5 years ago. I didn't expect she'd want to hear from me now. At 5:30, I dialed Dorothy's number. It was an hour later in Chicago, where she'd been living for the last year. She had always been an early riser. I didn't suppose the habits of 20 years had changed simply because she no longer had to escape my morning breath. I debated about whether to turn the video pickup on, but I figured Dorothy deserved that much at least. The news would be hard enough without getting it from a blank screen. I could have had the local cops go by her house. That's what the book probably suggested in these cases. She answered on the third ring, a little out of breath and slightly flushed. I'd interrupted her morning aerobics routine. Her endorphins would be elevated, which might help with the trauma of the next few minutes. Dorothy hadn't changed much over the years, still tall, willowy and blonde, with the kind of face designed to carry the years well, even without the benefits of modern medical science. She looked a lot more than 5 years younger than me. I didn't say anything, not even hello. Sat there staring at her and past her at the usual clutter of her trendy apartment. In the background, a wall screen was showing coverage of the American Mars mission launch from the Endeavour space platform. It had been moved ahead 2 weeks to keep pace with the Chinese and European programs. I stared stupidly at the video image of the video and said nothing.
"Frank, to what do I owe?"
She stopped then. "Dot, I've got..."
"Oh, Jesus, it's Joshua."
"I guess I need to go back to basic training, relearn that sympathetic but neutral cop expression we're supposed to use when we break the news."
"Is he... all right?"
She finished the question, though she already knew the answer. "He's dead." She took it better than I thought she would. No hysterics, no screaming. Her face sort of collapsed into its ears. She turned away for a moment and rubbed a tissue across her eyes. I heard a couple of soft sobs, but when she turned back, she was calm.
"How did it happen? Some kind of accident?"
I didn't answer. Somehow couldn't make my throat form the words and let them go.
"Not suicide?"
Dorothy's grandfather had killed himself. It had almost destroyed her family, and she lived in terror it might be genetic. She'd talked to a lot of doctors and even made Josh take screening, but she never really believed their reassurances. Maybe that made it easier to tell her. Maybe I thought murder would be a relief. "Josh was killed. Somebody murdered our son." Her face hardened then, and her eyes turned cold.
"Joshua stopped being your son a long time ago."
I wondered when exactly that had happened. A long time ago, I guess, just like Dorothy said. I remembered him when he was little, how much I loved to hold him and play with him, watch him discover all the things the world had to offer. Then I accidentally shot my partner during a botched operation, blew half his head off. After that, I spent 8 years up my own asshole, going from work to counseling to bars. I finally kicked the counseling habit, but by then Jack Daniels was my best friend, and my little boy had grown into an angry teenager. And a few years after that, we decided to call the whole thing off. And now, when I'd finally gotten well enough to want to have a family again, it was way too late for any of us. It was time for me to do what I do best and be a cop. "I have a few questions. It may help with our investigation."
"I'm sorry I said that, Frank. Really, I..."
She probably was. But words are like bullets. Once fired, they can't be put back in the gun. "Do you have someone you can call? Someone who can come over after we're done talking?" "By the book."
"I guess. Sure, I can."
She was starting to look a little confused. "Put me on hold and make that call." She stared at me, maybe wondering who the hell I was. Then the screen went blank. A minute later she came back, under control again. She'd been a cop's wife for 20 years. She knew a little about this stuff, too. "Did Joshua, have any enemies?" I asked.
"No. Everybody loved Joshua."
Obviously not everyone did, but I let it go. "When did you see him last?"
"Must be 6 months. No, 7. He came down here for a long weekend, but I talked to him about 2 weeks ago. He had started a new job, something to do with... oh, I forget. I have his work number. I'll flash it to you."
She tapped a couple of numbers on the console, and my phone pinged to indicate the number was now logged in memory. "How did he seem?"
"Happy, excited, optimistic, the way he always was."
It wasn't how I remembered him, but I took her word for it. "How long had Joshua been a Borg?"
"My son wasn't a Borg."
I blinked. Had Chin been wrong about the nature of the crime? Fooled by the mutilation and the body in the dumpster? Was it a copycat, or just a simple homicide that looked like one of ours? I felt a rush of relief. I could ship the case over to the newly minted superintendent of homicide, Willa O'Reilly, and get it off the books of the Special Detection Unit.
I mean, Dorothy continued, he was like all kids, enamored with what was new and different. He hung with that dress-up crowd at college.
A wannabe, maybe, I thought. So he hadn't had any surgery.
Well, yes, he'd had one of those voice things done.
An augment or an actual vocoder? I asked.
The second, I think. And he was talking a couple of months ago about having something done to his hand. I'm not sure if he did it. I didn't pay much attention. I thought it was a fad, like when he spent all his money on those old comic books, or wanted to try out for the space program because everyone else in his class wanted to, remember?
I didn't, but I nodded anyway.
That doesn't make him a Borg, does it?
The door chimed behind her and Dorothy waved it open. I was oddly gratified when a woman came through it. We'd been divorced for 7 years and we'd both moved on, but you never actually went to see your replacement. I'll have a detective call you if we have any more questions, I said. If you need anything, well, you have my number. She nodded absently and turned toward her friend, cutting the connection as she did. I leaned back in my chair and stared up at the water stain patterns on the ceiling of my office. My ex might be in denial, but I had no doubt that sometime in the last year my son had found enough cash to begin his transformation into something new and different. And that had made someone think he was a prime candidate for murder. I went down to the cafeteria for a cup of the sludge they call coffee. When I got back, the message icon on my phone was practically dancing. It was 6:02, so I didn't need 3 guesses to know who wanted my attention so badly. Chief Arsenault always started his day at 6 sharp. He wouldn't have needed a minute to decide I should be his first order of business. The chief and I were getting along better these days. Hard-earned mutual respect will do that for you. We weren't exactly buddies, but at least I didn't think of him as Chief Arsehole. Not often, anyway. Still, this wasn't going to be easy. I readied my arguments as to why I shouldn't be hauled off the Borg case now that I had a personal interest in the outcome. I hit reply, and the chief's cherubic face popped into view as if he knew I was already at my desk and had been waiting for my response. Which was probably the case. The chief kept a pretty close watch on his senior officers. "Frank," he said, "I'm sorry for your loss. I always liked Joshua." His usual warm smile had been replaced with a look of concern that might even have been real. I decided I needed to give him the benefit of the doubt. After all, he seemed to know no one called my son Josh anymore, which put him a leg up on me. "Thanks. I appreciate that. I've been thinking of assigning this case to Superintendent O'Reilly," Arsenault said. "She does have extensive experience with the Borg." I bristled at that, even though I had expected it. I had a lot of respect for Willa. More than that, our friendship had survived several years of butting heads at work, and one night, 6 months ago, of bumping uglies at her condo when need overcame common sense. But the Borg murders were exactly the kind of cases the Special Detection Unit had been set up to handle. "You're worried I'll lose my perspective," I said. "Always," said Arsenault, still not smiling. "Besides, I'd like you to focus on other parts of your caseload." Okay. Now I was thinking of him as Chief Arsehole. It always went this way. The chief would assign cases to the SDU that no one else wanted. The Borg murders qualified in spades. Most cops are dedicated public servants who do their best in difficult circumstances, but no one ever accuses them of having a deep tolerance for difference. Maybe different sounds too much like deviant. I don't have much use for what passes these days as journalism, but I'm not stupid. You don't survive very long as a superintendent in the SDU if you don't read the news feeds and tap into the webcasts. The press was having a field day with the idea of a Borg serial killer, alternating between a sick fascination with the grisly details and vicious speculation on whether the culprit should be hunted down or given a medal. Even the politicians had gotten into the act. The last election had left the governing Liberals in a minority. The new Unity Party had jumped from a single member to second place, and while their leader, James Becker, always sounded reasonable, some of the members who had joined him on the opposition benches made the third-place conservatives look like communists. They were full of ruminations about holy retribution for those who had defiled God's sacred work. Body modification had become the new evil in their eyes, though it didn't seem to stop any of them from participating in the other wonders of modern science to improve and lengthen their lives. Arsenault didn't just listen to the news, he bathed in it. When the winds of political change blew, he bent like a willow rather than fell like an oak. Which, I guess, is why he's the longest-serving chief the Calgary police force ever had. It's also why he wanted to move the Borg killings onto the back burner. But, damn it, this was the SDU's case. I'd turn the investigation over to Sanchez if I had to, but I wanted it here, where I could keep my eyes on things. I must have had a blank look on my face. At least I hoped it was blank and not a reflection of my thoughts. "Are you all right, Frank?" Arsenault sounded worried now, not concerned about my dead son, but apprehensive his most senior superintendent was heading for the psych ward up at Ponoka. "Never been better, Chief," I said. Probably not the best response given the circumstances. Arsenault looked like he was going to personally sign the committal papers. "If I could be frank with you," I said, falling back on one of my oldest jokes, "Joshua and I weren't that close." Just close enough that his death was like a fist in my belly. "I can keep this in perspective. I have to. It's my job. We're not dealing with a single random murder. There's a pattern. The details aren't clear, but they're getting there, and I have closer ties to the Borg than Willa ever will." "You're staying connected to Wanamaker." A statement of fact, not a question. Chief Arsenault does like to stay informed. "Yeah," I said, "we're like brothers." Not exactly true, but I wasn't going to tell the chief that. He resented the fact that Buzz Wanamaker, Calgary's first Borg detective, had quit the very moment the going was at its toughest. Never mind, he did so right before Arsenault could first fire and then arrest him. None of us were thinking clearly at the time. The chief wanted to fire and arrest me, and the rest of the SDU, too. But only Wanamaker refused to come back when it was all over and done with. Forgive and forget wasn't a big part of his personality.
"Do you think he can or will help you?"
"Sure," I said. "We're in regular touch." Another white lie. I hadn't talked to Buzz in a month, but I was in touch with Darwal Singh, Buzz's partner in the detective agency they had recently set up, using Dar's money and Buzz's street creds. I was heading out to see him when you called. The chief looked doubtful, but he finally nodded. "Keep me apprised of developments. I don't need to tell you how sensitive this is." It was almost too easy. The screen went blank. The absence of niceties to end the conversation was a little more typical of the chief's approach, and it gave me a sense of normalcy. To the extent that having your world come unglued is ever normal. There wasn't much point in going to Singh's office before business hours, and we weren't so close that I wanted to drop by his apartment unannounced. So I lay on the couch to catch up on my report reading. Amazingly, I didn't fall asleep, though I didn't get through many reports either. At 7:45, I gave up and checked Singh's agency address on my palm top. I pinged the other members of the unit to gather in the conference room at 2 that afternoon for a case review. I forwarded my phone to my cell, which for once I remembered to put in my pocket. As an afterthought, I took my service revolver out of my desk drawer. I couldn't find my shoulder holster, so I shoved the gun in the right pocket of my suit and headed out the door to see what Sing and Wanamaker had to offer. I doubted it would bring me any joy.